Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes award-winning memoirist, critic, and best-selling author of The Lost, Daniel Mendelsohn. Mendelsohn's new book is An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and an Epic, a deeply moving tale of a father and son's transformative journey in reading and reliving Homer's epic masterpiece. Monday, October 16th at 7 p.m., more at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
From the Baltimore Sun in Baltimore, Maryland, I'm Dan Rogericks, Baltimore Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 308, for Thursday, the 12th day of October 2017. On today's show, Rashearn Baker. He's the Prince George's County executive, a Democrat, and one of several candidates who want to run against Maryland's Republican governor, Larry Hogan, next year. This is another in our series of interviews with candidates. Rashearn Baker served in the Maryland General Assembly before becoming Prince George's County executive in 2010. He came into that office after a big scandal that saw his predecessor, Jack Johnson, plead guilty to corruption charges involving county business officials, developers, and his wife. Johnson went to prison, Rashearn Baker went on to clean things up and to stabilize county government. Now he has his sights set on Annapolis. In this conversation, we hear about Rashearn Baker's life before politics and what he feels he accomplished as a state delegate and county executive. One thing you'll hear about, Prince George's County's Transforming Neighborhoods Initiatives, or the TNI, a strategy to help some troubled parts of the county reduce crime and blight and to improve their schools. Rashearn Baker, welcome back to the podcast. It's nice to see you again.
Good to be back with you, Dan.
Why are you running for governor?
Well, I'm running for governor because that is really where the center of the action is. And if you want to change things the way that I've tried to change things when I was as county executive and when I was in a legislature or even in the private sector, it's where you get to make the decisions to change the face of Maryland. And there are issues I care deeply about, like public education, the health, job creation, and public safety. And from the governor's standpoint, you can have a greater impact on people's lives, and that's what I want to do.
Let's start with some biography for folks who don't know you, don't know your whole life story, and then we'll talk about a couple issues in the time that we have today. Where were you born? Where'd you grow up?
Well, I was born in Valdosta, Georgia, which a lot of people don't realize, because I grew up in the military. My dad moved around a lot. We moved around. He spent 30 years in the military. As a young kid, I had trouble reading. I talk about this a lot. Early on in the first and second grade, I had to repeat those grades. So I started, 2 years older than my peers and moving. And that caused issues in and of itself where, we'd move to a new base. Somebody would ask me my age, and then they'd start laughing, and then I'd get into a fight, and I'd get kicked out.
But they didn't believe that you were a couple years older than them?
No, they didn't. And, and when you're young, kids can be bullying and things of that nature. And so for me, it's why public education is so important, because when you struggle when you're younger with reading or with understanding, and then you throw on top of that you're new and, you get into trouble by fighting. And for me, that became a pattern. So I told my kids when to follow their mother's example and not mine. I got kicked out of school in the United States and Okinawa, Japan. But I had great parents.
How old were you when that happened?
I actually started having trouble in school probably from third grade on to about ninth grade. Really struggled with reading and understanding, and always felt a little different than the other kids in the class. Not just being older, but not being able to understand or get it as quickly. And when you, especially in the younger grades, and we see this now, it's a wider gap when you feel that way. You feel like you're ostracized. You're afraid to ask for help.
Were you actually expelled from schools?
Yes.
When you were a teenager or before that?
Before that. I probably would have repeated the fifth grade had it not been for the fact that my dad got back from Vietnam and we were moving. But clearly I was having issues. If somebody picked on me, I always accepted the challenge.
So you got into fights?
Got into fights. Fights was most of it.
Looking back on that, what do you think of a school expelling someone who's in the fifth grade?
It's not the answer. It really is. I mean, if you think about what the policies we've changed, and we did this in Prince George's County, one of the things that we're doing now is we're looking at health, and especially behavioral health at the early ages. You know, what is it that's going on with you to cause you to act out? Well, you know, rather than expelling me, it would have been better to have me have the teachers and have, you know, folks work with me. That happened. I mean, it actually happened when we came back to the States.
So you were in Japan for a while.
I was in Japan for a while.
Was your dad in the Army?
He was in the Army. He was a Green Beret. Had done two tours in Vietnam, and we ended up going to Okinawa, Japan. And we stayed there for about 3.5 years. So I went there when I was probably about 13, came back around 16. And this got me into politics, really. When we came back to the States, we moved to a place in Beverly, Massachusetts, which was about an hour outside of Boston. Well, Beverly, Mass was all white when we moved there. There was one black family, and we were it.
And you were a teenager.
I was a teenager.
So what was that like for you?
It was good that I had a big family. You know, there were four of us. But we were amazed that there were no other people of color when we walked around the school.
How were you treated in that school?
You know, really well. You know, it was, the treatment was no different. I mean, people were kind of surprised. They thought we were from Lynn, Massachusetts, or from Boston. It was actually more different to go from a military school, military base, to go to civilian life, you know, especially in those days.
You say that piqued your interest in politics.
It was a teacher. What happened was, I was a really good football player. It's hard for people to believe this now. You know, my wife would tease me about it. But at that time, I was a really good football player, and I thought I was going to be a football star. And so, you know, most people would just allow me to play football. They'd kind of, you know, overlook the troubles that I was having in class. And when I came to this school, you know, I was really good. So they were trying to get me on the field to play, and I wasn't passing my English test, my English class. And so I talked to the teacher and said, hey, you know, can I just get this C? And that way I can get to the field and play. You know, normally I could charm them. And she said, no. She said, no, if you want to play, here's what you have to do. You're going to do, because you have potential, and I'm going to make you do extra work, and you're going to have to come after class. And so she gave me an assignment to read one or two books, you know, at either Wuthering Heights or Black Boy. And since I didn't know anything about Wuthering Heights and didn't know anything about Black Boy, but I could count pages, I chose Black Boy. And by choosing that book, it just opened my eyes to everything that had happened before, because I never realized at that point how blessed I was to have the parents that I had and the teachers that I'd had, who at every stage that I got in trouble never gave up on me. I mean, they worked their best and their hardest to make sure that I was prepared to go to college. I mean, my father prepared for me to go to college, even though everything else said the opposite. And that book really made me feel guilty about all the opportunities I had squandered. It caused me to want to read everything Richard Wright read and wrote and understand how he got to be who he was. And then it made me want to say, well, how can I make my life different? Not just playing football or wandering around, but what can I do to give back to society? I wanted to change the world, which is not unusual for teenagers. You get a spark and you want to do it. And so for me, I was trying to find a way to make up for the amends that, you know, that I had that I had squandered for so long. And I started looking at politics. And my dad was so happy that I was interested. One, that I wasn't getting kicked out of school anymore, so that was a good thing. Two, I was interested in world, you know, views and world politics. And so he would watch debates, political debates with me. By this time, we had moved to Western Massachusetts, Springfield, and I was watching the local politician in a debate who had been there 20 years, one of the few African-American representatives, state rep. And, you know, I'm railing against this guy, and my dad turns to me and he says, if you think you can do better, then you should run for office, you know, not just sit here and complain about it, do something. And I turned to him like any 17 and a half year old would to their parent and said, that's what I'm going to do, because I know more than you.
Wait a minute, you're watching a televised debate?
I was watching a local televised debate.
Yeah, and you're like screaming at the TV. I am disagreement with one of the candidates.
Yes, I'm yelling at this guy on the, it's as clear as day. I'm yelling at this guy on. You have to remember, this is probably like local.
Yeah.
You know, TV.
I didn't even know Springfield had a TV station.
But okay. No, sorry. Yes, we had our local station there, and yeah. This guy's on there.
And your father challenged you.
And he challenged me. And I don't think he ever thought that, you know, I would go into politics. I wasn't, you know, his aim. He wanted his children to be good Americans, good citizens, productive. But he didn't like people who complained. He liked action. And that's what kind of person he was. And I was going to show him that you could run for office, hold on to your principles, and make changes. I mean, very naive at the time, but it motivated me then. It's the same thing that motivates me now. I'm not much different in that philosophy than I was as a 17-year-old kid.
So by then, you were on a college track. Where'd you go to college?
I ended up going to Howard University for the very same reason. Howard University was in Washington, D.C., and if you want to get into politics, people are in Washington, right? When I applied to Howard University and got in, my father thought they had made a mistake. He was like, there's no way you could have gotten this. Like,
he didn't think your grades were good enough? Or
My grades, my SAT, he was like, I love you, son, but you're going to go to the local school. He did not think it. So he actually called the university up to make sure they didn't make a mistake. And lucky for me, it was not a mistake. I was blessed to get in Howard. It was clearly somebody in the registrar's office felt bad for me and said, let's take a chance on this guy.
Did you study political science?
I started off in political science, and then I changed my major to history.
What did you do with that? What did you do after college?
I ended up going to law school. The history part I loved very much, but once again, I wanted to go into politics. And, you know, the folks that I saw who were in politics were lawyers, and so that was the track I went on. You know, now that I'm older, I tell people you can go in from any profession into public service. It doesn't really matter. But I was young then, and so law school is where I went next.
Did you go to Howard Law?
I went to Howard, which, once again, was just great, and you had people, you know, like Thurgood Marshall had come out of there, Spotswood Robinson, you know, some of the best and brightest minds.
What was your ambition by then in terms of the law? What kind of a practice did you think you'd have?
You know, I never really thought I would practice law. I really was more focused on understanding the law for legislative purposes to go into changing, you know, people's lives and going into public service. That was my goal.
Before we move on, I don't want to leave your family behind. Tell us a little bit about your mother.
You know, my mom is the most amazing person. My dad did 30 years in the military, and my mom, you know, I say to people, my dad inspired me to go into public service, but my mom raised me, because when my dad was doing tours in Vietnam, she raised us while she still worked. My mom worked as a nurse's aide. And so she would make us, you know, I have two brothers and one sister. My older brother and I, if we wanted to use her car, we had to come and pick her up at the nursing home she worked in. We had to come 30 minutes early. And part of it was you had to go around and talk to her patients. As a teenager, it just irritated us.
Yeah.
We were like, you know, we really don't want to do this.
Right.
Tell them
but
what
she
we
felt
did.
That it was important for you to... That they needed some attention from young people?
They needed attention. But, you know, she wouldn't say it that way. She'd say, you know, crazy boy, get in there and tell them what you did today. Even when I came home from college, I'd had to go to these folks, you know, and tell them about my day, my year, you know, whatever. People whose family didn't visit them, we became and she became their family. And she didn't say, here, I'm teaching you about healthcare.
Just do it.
Just do it.
Right.
It took me from 17 to 34 when I was elected to the House of Delegates. And my dad came down when I was sworn in Annapolis. And he stayed with me for 2 weeks in Annapolis, which I thought was weird because dad never did that. And what I didn't know at the time was that he was dying. He had Agent Orange, and he knew it. We didn't. And he got a chance to see me on the floor, give a speech, and he was just so proud. But he never saw me again. And
do you have cancer that developed from Agent Orange exposure?
Yes. He knew it. We didn't know it.
How long was it before he died after you were sworn in Annapolis?
So I was sworn in January. He died in October.
What did you do in those years before you went into the Maryland General Assembly, after college and before your election?
You know, I had one of the greatest jobs that trained me to be county executive and probably is going to give me the experience to be governor. And that is, I work for a community development corporation called People's Involvement Corporation. And at the time, the responsibility was both social work and economic development in D.C. in some of the hardest hit areas from the riots. And our job was to figure out how we could build affordable housing, take neighborhoods that had been decimated for years after the 68 riots and redo them, inspire businesses to expand. And at the same time, we provided, a welfare to work program, which is what they called it at the time, shelters for battered women, which is what they called it at the time. All of those issues as a young 20-year-old something lawyer coming out, I had to work on and never thought it was. In fact, I complained to my wife. I said, I want to go into politics and I'm stuck here working with this community nonprofit when really I should be doing policy things and working on Capitol Hill and all of that stuff. And I stayed there for 10 years, never planning to stay longer than two before I run for office. And I never realized that experience in those 10 years working for that nonprofit, everything I did there is what I do as county executive right now. You think about the issues that I get an update every day on, whether it's public safety, whether it's health and human services, whether it's education, redevelopment, how do we change neighborhoods? As a young person, I got to see that firsthand. So I tell my kids, if you go to D.C. and you go on U Street or H Street or 14th Street, these are like the popping places in D.C. That's where I worked. They didn't look like that when we started, but now they're hot areas. So that's what I did before being elected.
How long were you in the General Assembly?
I was in there for 8 years.
What is your takeaway from those 8 years?
God, I loved being in the House of Delegates, and I loved going there, every session. And
you actually used the word fun.
It was fun. I mean, for me, for you just think about it. You want to do something your whole life, and you get a chance to do it. And I was lucky. I had some tremendous mentors. Probably the person who had the most impact on my career in Annapolis and things that I do here was Pete Rawlings.
The father of our former mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake.
That's right.
Howard Pete Rawlings, larger-than-life man who really knew the legislature and the budget especially, didn't he?
He knew it forwards and backwards. Pete was a teacher. He would have, folks that he would try and mentor in the General Assembly. Talmadge Branch was one, and there were
He actually was a teacher, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was a professor.
He was a professor, and he was that way. So I used to stand up on the floor and give these speeches, just really, once again, almost like when I was 17, railing against whatever was going on, usually the budget. And I didn't like what they were doing in the budget, and I'd, vote against it, and I'd rail against it. And I remember one time giving a speech, which I thought was a very good speech, and Pete Rawlings, the chair of appropriation, the powerful chair of the appropriations, walked to my desk on the floor, which he never came over. So it frightened everybody else. They were like, oh, my God. And he says to me, that was a good speech. And I looked at him, kind of smarted out. And I said, it really was. And he said to me, how many votes did you change? And I looked at the board, and I looked at what he said, and I didn't change any. He said, okay. He said, if you really want to learn how the legislature works and how to get things done, come see me. And I did. And what he said to me was, I don't know if you just like hearing yourself talk, or you actually want to get things done. I don't know you well enough, but I'm willing to, give you a chance. If you come to my office tomorrow morning, and it's funny, I remember the issue exactly. He was having a meeting with folks from University of Maryland Medical System and about health. And I was there at the office at the assigned time because you couldn't be late for the chairman. And he had me sit, if you've ever been to Pete's office at the time, he had a couch and then he had his desk right there and he had two chairs. And he told me to sit on the couch, and he brought the people in for their meeting, which looked really weird because I'm sitting on the couch as he's getting ready to conduct business. And they were talking about Prince George's Hospital, and Pete was trying to find a way to save the hospital. So I'm listening to these folks talk, and, I want to talk myself. And so I got ready to say something, and Chairman Rawlings looked at me and he said, sit down. You're here to listen, not to talk. So he finished his meeting. Afterwards, he said, you're here to listen. If you ever start talking again, I will kick you out and you won't be back. Just think about it. For young people, especially, I'm 38 at the time, a lawyer. You know, I practiced law. I've done these things, and I've got to sit there and be quiet when this interesting discussion is going on.
Mm-hmm. You're champing at the bit to say something.
I am, and I, you know, and what he wanted to show me is I needed to listen first and understand, and then he was going to show me how to get things done. And when I showed up the next morning, as hard as it was, you know, I listened to what was going on. And from that moment on, what he taught me was how to get a bill from one house to the other. And the most significant piece of legislation I passed was the restructuring of Prince George's County school system. And it was Pete Rollins who taught me how to do that. And no one else had done it before, but he showed me how to get a bill out of the House and having an impact on the local education system in a way that I thought would improve it as a delegate.
Did he teach you how to listen?
He taught me how to listen, which was a really hard thing for me because, you know, I'm impatient and I want to talk and I got a lot to say. But he did. As county executive, I wouldn't have known how to pass difficult legislation. You think of the things that in the first four years of our administration, the bills that we passed in Annapolis, you know, significant ethics reform when the entire county council was against it. Being able to go to Annapolis and get that through the legislature.
And that was significant given who your predecessor was in Prince George's County, right?
Exactly. You know, the county executive had been arrested and was on his way to jail. And many, you know, we had five brand new county council members and even the current ones who were returning. All of them said, well, I don't need to, you know, and the legislation did this. It said that you could not as a county executive or a council member accept money from developers, that if people who are coming into your jurisdiction in Prince George's County want to develop, then you couldn't accept money from them. It sounds like a simple thing, except 90% of the money raised for campaigns in Prince George's County and in other parts of our state are raised from developers. So when you cut off that money, it cut off the chance for incumbents to use it. And so they were just really not happy. And even people on my own staff said, that's insane. Why would you cut off your ability to raise money, you know, once you get in office? And to me, it was sending a signal to the business community, to the community at large, that things in Prince George's County would be different. But in order to pass that, I had to understand how the legislature works. And to get it done. And so that I learned from Pete Rollins.
You've been Prince George's County Executive how long now?
I've been County Executive 7 years.
What has been your most significant accomplishment as Prince George's County Executive, would you say? What's the thing you're most proud of?
Our Transforming Neighborhoods Initiative.
The
TNI. And the reason is because those six areas that we focus on at the beginning of the administration were the areas that were the most forgotten for the past 30, 40 years in Prince George's County. And it was a hard lift to get people to understand that we were going to focus all of our time, effort, and resources in turning around those six areas because their transformation would impact the county as a whole. And that was a hard sell for council members and for the community at large.
Why was it a hard sell?
Because every council member, we don't elect council members at large. They're elected from districts. And we had a budget deficit, and so what they knew, and what I was very honest with, was we're not going to be able to fund all 500 square miles of our county. What limited resources we have, we're going to go into these six areas. When we're talking about additional money for our education system, it really is focused on these areas. Healthcare is going to be focused on these areas. If the business community says, we want to come in and do development, and we want your help as a county, that's the area we're going to focus on first. So it meant that there were some areas we were not actually going to spend county money on. We were going to make sure that regulations, they got that. But county money in the beginning until things turned around was really going to be in these areas. And so for someone who's representing the northern part of Prince George's County, Laurel area, Bowie, or the southern part, you know, or Mitchellville or Fort Washington, and they could say, well, you know, we paid a lion's share of taxes in the county. Why aren't we getting, you know, equity? And so convincing people that was hard. And then the second part, if I can real quick, is the areas we identified, people didn't want to be identified as a T&I area. They were like, well, that says there's something wrong
with this. There's
trouble here. There's trouble here. And wouldn't that just scare people away? And so convincing both the council and the areas to accept it was a hard deal. And also convincing them this wasn't a gimmick.
It's been about 5 or 6 years now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what are the results generally? Are they mostly positive? I know there's been crime reduction.
There's been crime reduction. We've seen an increase in graduation rates in those schools and the economic development. So much so, there were a couple of areas that actually graduated out of the T&I, area, and they didn't want to graduate out. So Riverdale's Bladensburg, East Bladensburg.
The attention, huh?
They like the fact that the resources there, they know how to access government. And just think about it. They were meeting one-on-one with the directors and deputy county administrators, probably for the first time in monthly meetings. It was a requirement that every part of my government or their government be represented in their town meetings. Every month, once a month, the community meeting, you would have somebody from every single department in Prince George's County government, plus the state's attorney's office, the sheriff's office, and the school. That was part of your monthly meeting. You can ask anybody. So if you want to talk about the environment, here's the director or deputy.
And is this continuing today?
It's continuing today. But the folks who – so what we've seen is economic development going up in East Riverdale is where the new Whole Foods is. It's on that area there. So you're seeing job creation. And it's helped turn around the county.
Okay, people start thinking about who they're going to vote for governor next year. They look at the present governor. Some people voted for Larry Hogan. A lot of people didn't vote for Larry Hogan, but enough voted for Larry Hogan to make him governor. And they look at him and say, well, he reduced the highway tolls. He's going to widen the highways. He killed the red line in Baltimore, saved us a ton of money on a light rail system for Baltimore City. My roads are better out here in Anne Arundel County or Garrett County. Things are pretty good. Why should we change?
I mean, the governor's got to make his case for why he should be reelected. Here are the issues that trouble me that I see. The easy stuff, if you're going to lead, it's not just doing the easy things. It's making the tough choices that make life better for everyone. And by that, I mean, if you look at Maryland in terms of, job creations, we've been able to create, lead the state in job creation in Prince George's County because we made some really tough decisions. We increased the amount of money that we had in our economic development incentive fund from zero to $50 million. The state has the same type of incentive fund that's at $70 million, but they don't use that the same way we did. We use it to spur businesses to come into Prince George's County and create jobs, especially the small and medium-sized businesses. Imagine what we could do if we had the help of the state doing that, not just saying we're open for business, but going into business, like going into areas like Garrett County or, the Eastern Shore, or coming here in Baltimore City, not just down the downtown area, but out, and using that as an incentive together with the local fund to go in and incentivize small and medium-sized business, which do the majority of the hiring, to come into those areas. We don't see that. We don't see aggressive action on that from the governor's office. We don't see aggressive action on looking at regulations that stop businesses from developing in areas. Healthcare. Because of the affordable health care, we were able to reduce the number of uninsured and underinsured across the state of Maryland, and especially in places like Baltimore City and Prince George's County and the Eastern Shore. But we know there's got to be some changes to the Affordable Care Act. There's always this threat of that it's going to go away, which means people are opting out. So where's Maryland's plan to deal with the Affordable Care Act as it is now?
Piece of that I want to ask you about is some $2 billion or so they're talking about losing if the Congress decides to roll back the federal commitment on Medicaid to Maryland. How do we pick that up?
Exactly. I mean, so...
Well, how do we? Do you have a plan for that?
There's two things that we have to do it as. One is we can't simply wait and figure out what happens on the federal level. I mean, we can't be passive about it. We've got to actively say we don't want this to happen. We've got to actively lobby, our federal representative, but also the president and his representative say we've got to stop this. And we're not doing that. We're sitting back waiting. That's not a Republican or Democrat issue. Charlie Baker in Massachusetts is doing that. He's a Republican. Kasich or Ohio is doing that. So one is we got to be aggressively going after, you know, the federal government to stop these policies. On the other, we've got to prepare for it. So where do we get the money to do it? What are we now not going to fund in order to make it a priority? As the governor, you have to make those decisions. Just like as county executive, I want the hospital built to save lives. I had to say to folks, well, we can't do these programs. We cut our government by 5% in the first 4 years because we devoted money to education and public safety and health. That's the same type of commitment we have to make here. And that's what I want to, you know, as governor, that's what I would do. Healthcare is a critical issue. It's a priority, which means there are going to be things that we would love to do, but we can't do as a state.
So you're saying you'd have to start planning for it.
You have to start planning
for it. You might not have a plan yet, but you're saying you have to start planning for it.
You have to start planning for it because, as I said, even if the Affordable Care Act stayed the way it is, it still has issues. So why aren't we preparing for it? So what we're doing in Prince George's County and what we need to do in the state is we put together a group to look at an alternative plan for us in the county to deal with whether we lose the Affordable Care Act, whether it stays the same. Well, why aren't we planning that at the state level? You know, you have the Secretary of Health and Mental Hygiene. That person should be leading the effort, not, you know, the health officer of Baltimore City, who's absolutely great, because they can only speak for Baltimore City. Prince George's County can only speak for Prince George's County. The governor speaks for the state, and that's where they should be coming together.
What would you say your top priority is? Is it economic development? Is it education? Those are the two that we usually hear about from candidates.
Yeah, I think that the top priorities are in this order. It's certainly jobs, and that's what, you know, comes across as economic development. If you can't create jobs, then, you know, if a person doesn't have a job, then it stops right there. So providing good quality jobs for folks. The other is education, because that's your road to quality of life and employment. And then health, because the health has an impact on all of those things. It has an impact on jobs. It has an impact on education. It has an impact on
cost
public
of living.
Saving.
Okay, I mentioned public transportation or transportation in passing there because Larry Hogan is the roads governor. I call him the roads warrior. He wants to widen highways. You've seen this plan. It's a $9 billion idea to widen highways in the future, public-private partnerships. We've seen him walk away from mass transit projects, the Red Line for one in Baltimore. That's the main one.
Yeah.
So where's Rashearn Baker on all of that?
Yeah, I think he's absolutely wrong in his approach. When we talk about economic development and creating jobs, that's really what public transportation is about. That's why we fund things like the metro system and light rail and the Purple Line in the Washington region. And that's why you need it in the Red Line here in Baltimore City. You need a way to drop job centers around the county and around the city and in Baltimore County.
Would you revive that plan for Baltimore?
I would. I think I would revive it. I would take another look at it because I think what you do with transit is the investment in those are not just to get people back and forth, but is also to create jobs around there. And so for me, the Red Line in Baltimore City, much like the Purple Line in Prince George's County and Montgomery County, Anne Arundel County, those places. We never advocated for one without the other. When Ike Leggan and I met with the governor about the Purple Line, we also talked about the Red Line. The fact that we understood that for economic centers in the state, you have to create, you know, mass transportation. That's why when he talks about widening the roads in 270 and the Beltway, it's a crazy proposition, one, because you're taking all of this money and you're putting it into these areas where it's only going to increase the volume of cars on the road. It doesn't. And then it doesn't talk about taking federal land in order to do it. So you need federal permission to do that, which they don't have. The other is you're actually in Prince George's County section. You're taking a large swath of people's properties without telling them that that would happen. And you don't know whether the plan will work in terms of making the quality of life better. The answer should be mass transit and then creating job centers from where people are coming from. That's why we spent so much time trying to to bring jobs to Prince George's County, so you didn't have the whole county leaving every morning. So you create the job opportunities there.
So my own newspaper here nudged you a little bit about advocating that Amazon HQ2.
No, they didn't, did they?
Yeah, they did. And you had a response to it. So I'll give you a chance to respond on the podcast. The Sun thinks Port Covington is a great location for HQ2 of Amazon. 50,000 jobs they're talking about, right? Anybody would love to have that kind of economic development. That's enough economic development for 10 years in some states. You suggested Prince George's County. The Sun says, well, that's competing with us here in Baltimore. That's not a good idea.
I thought it was very interesting. But, you know, I think the site at Port Covington is a good site and should be submitted for the Amazon second headquarters. I'm for that. They're looking at urban areas. And so certainly the Baltimore region is an area that should apply. In the Washington area, there are going to be applications. We've got great sites in Prince George's County that I think we should submit. And I think the state wants to be able to have the best projects to go after this, you know, game changer. And so to go after it with the best proposals we have throughout the state that's going to attract the most attention, I think, is the best way to approach it. That doesn't mean we don't want, you know, the Baltimore region to submit a project. No, we want to win. At the end of the day, in Maryland, we want to win this project, this headquarters, because it creates jobs for Marylanders. So we want to have the best sites. If we don't submit something in Prince George's County or Montgomery County, then the Washington region gets submitted by Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia. Do we want to lose out on the opportunity to have a headquarters to Washington, D.C. and to Northern Virginia? No, we want our best proposals, and that's what we advocated for.
We're several months away from the primary. The Democratic primary is in June 2018. What do you want people to think about when they think about Sherm Baker between now and then?
Yeah, what I want them to think about is that in these times of challenges that we have facing us as in our personal lives, but also as a state and as a nation, what are the skill and judgments we want in a governor? And what I say to folks, if you look at both my work in the private sector, you know, working for a national nonprofit around education reform, public education reform, or the 10 years I spent working for community development around affordable housing and issues of that nature, or the 8 years in Annapolis, both on appropriations, passing critical legislation around the budget, or on judiciary dealing with social justice issues, and then the 7 years of taking a county that basically had no economic development and being able to change it so that 7 years later we lead the state in job creations, we lead the state in rising home values, our education system is improving, our crime is down to a 30-year low. When you take all of those perspectives together, that's what I would bring to the governor's mansion, somebody who understands the private sector, who understands legislature, and also understands what it takes to be an executive. And I hope that's what people think about when they go vote.
Well, Sherm Baker, thank you very much, and please come back and visit us again.
I will. Thank you for having me.
We'll invite Sherm Baker back for another conversation early next year. The Maryland gubernatorial primary is in June 2018. You can hear my other interviews with candidates Jim Shea, Ben Jealous, and Alec Ross by going to the Roughly Speaking archives at BaltimoreSun.com. There's a page devoted just to those conversations. Or just check the previous episodes on your podcast app. That's our show for now. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, this is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance. It really helps. And we'll see you Friday for our weekend show.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.